Every community has a place where people gather and stories are told. The East Coast has stoops, the South has porches, and in Alaska, we have Arctic entries.
Here, Alaskans share their personal stories, funny, sad, and sweet. These stories are originally told at a monthly event in Anchorage. At each live performance, seven people tell a seven-minute-long true story related to the show's theme.
I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards.
Welcome to Arctic Entries on KSKA, Anchorage.
During this hour, we'll hear stories from self-starters, pioneers, and homesteaders.
Stories very appropriate for Alaska. Our theme today is sourdoughs.
As many of you know, we call our old-timer Alaskans sourdoughs. It's a nickname that generated way back in the Gold Rush times, when miners used to carry their pouch of sourdough starter around their necks.
And on this episode of Arctic Entries, we will hear from old-timers, but we'll also hear from newer Alaskans who happen to be pioneers of sorts, in their own way. Like this guy.
So I've chosen to name this story Tales from the Dumpsters of Anchorage in Mid-December, The Sourdough Chronicles. Okay. I can't believe I'm telling you this. So,
all these stories were told in April 2012 at the Snow Goose Theater in Anchorage. They're part of our live event the second Tuesday of each month.
And our first story is from longtime Alaskan Barbara Brown. She's a writer, speaker, humorist, and activist. Barbara has experience telling stories in front of very tough crowds. She was the storytime lady for preschoolers at the Alaska Botanical Gardens for 14 years. Here's her story of good instincts, bad underwear, and her time as a feminist pioneer.
To understand how this story has anything to do with pioneers, you have to know who Congresswoman Bella Abzug was. Yes, she was loud, brassy, Jewish from New York City, and she wore big hats. She went to Congress in 1970 to fight against the Vietnam War and fight for women's rights. In 1972, five radical feminist college women went to Washington, D.C. to work for Bella. Oh, we were the cutting edge. Working for Bella Abzug was like working for Susan B. Anthony. My first day on the job, I fielded a phone call from Gloria Steinem. So, a little background here. I did not, at the time, wear attractive underwear. No nylon, no bikini, no patterns, no color. In fact, they were called white cotton Carter's underpant briefs. I was raised on them. They looked like men's jockey briefs for girls, but without the hole. And they were very white and very ugly and very thick, but they were really comfortable. Unfortunately, as far as underpants went, they were out of print. So I knew that the ones I had to last me forever. So in my drawer, I had two piles. I had the pile with elastic, and I could wear those with mini skirts and dresses. And then I had the pile without elastic that I could only wear with pants. And I couldn't even wear them with shorts because the crotch would hold them up and then they would hang out the sides and people could see them. Well, one day as I was racing for the bus early in the morning, I realized I had made a terrible mistake. And I was wearing a mini skirt with underwear with no elastic. And I knew this when they started falling down. So I hitched them up and I got up my seat on the bus and I kind of adjusted and I thought, okay, I can do this. I will walk around holding them up with my elbow on my hip. And then I will spend the entire day sitting at my desk and I will never get up. So we got to the office, and I got off the bus just like this, and it kind of worked just fine until a phone call came from Bella, and she said, quick, I need something on the floor of Congress. So I raced up to get it to her. I did it very carefully. I held on, and I raced down the hall like that. except I had to go to the bathroom very bad. And when I saw the public restroom, there was a long line. A tour bus had just emptied. And so I cheated and I yelled, "Congressional aid, I'm wanted on the floor." And I cut the line right to the front and grabbed a stall where I did my bit, except that I used up all the toilet paper that was left. So when I went out to wash my hands, I put my hand in the faucet. It was like a fire hydrant, and water shot out all over the place. And I had no time to dry or anything, but I was a good Samaritan as far as public restrooms went. And so I went to all the tour bus ladies on the line, and I said, "There's no more toilet paper left in the stall, so please remember to go in with tissues in your purse." And 20 pair of eyes look at the water trickling down my legs. And I got so rattled that I raced off. I forgot to hold up my underpants. And they had really sailed. They were down so low, my elbow could not reach them. And this was the floors of Congress, and I made a decision. I stepped out of them, and I raced off bare-butted and free. Well, about a half hour later, I did my stuff with Bella. I came back, and they were still there. And all the tour bus people were gingerly stepping over them in order to look at the statues and the portraits. So I very discreetly went up and snatched them and hid them and went back to the office, where everyone was in a tizzy because the first inaugural issue of Ms. Magazine had just come out. And there was an opinion piece there by Germaine Greer called "End the Tyranny of Knickers. Take Them Off." And we weren't quite sure, but we thought knickers was Australian for underpants. I was the cutting edge. So I turned to everybody and I said, "I'm not wearing any underpants." Now, Bella's office was not just radical feminist college women. There were also older liberal democratic Jewish ladies from New York City, like my mother. And they were really bothered by this. They kept staring at me and staring at the chair and staring at me. And I said, "I am not sitting on the chair, I'm sitting on my skirt." But it really bothered them. And on their lunch hour, they went out and they bought me a pair of underpants. And I said to them, "Thank you, but I don't do nylon and I don't do bikini." But out of respect for them, I went into the restroom and I took a stapler and I stapled my underpants on the sides, and they kind of stuck out like jodhpurs on the side. And even I knew those underpants had reached the end of their line.
That was Barbara Brown of Anchorage, and you're listening to Arctic Entries. Brandeis, have you ever heard the term chichaco? Chichaco, that was fun to say. Will you say it with me?
Chichaco. I've heard the term chichaco before. I was called a chichaco for several years. In fact, I think most people still consider me one. A chichaco is a newcomer to Alaska, someone unfamiliar or ignorant of the terrain, the weather, the culture, the animals. Basically, a chichaco is the opposite of a sourdough.
Yeah, we all give chichacos a lot of grief. But our next storyteller has a lesson in how you don't have to be a sourdough to be a pioneer. Here's Jeff Crompton. He moved to Alaska for school, skiing, and of course, a girl.
Well, I'll never forget the thrill of the first time. I was really excited and definitely really nervous. And there were limbs flying everywhere. This was the first time I went dumpster diving in Anchorage in the fall of 2007. So What is dumpster diving, first of all? All right, it's the act of getting in a dumpster and saving some of the, you know, perishable, semi-expired goods that might otherwise end up in a landfill just to rot and produce all sorts of methane gas. So got to find a good home for this stuff. And just a couple of things that I found, for example, like I found 2 months' supply of energy bars, a rear projector TV, and a good couch that I sit on to watch the broken TV. And also around Anchorage, there's lots of good sourdough half-fresh loaves. So I've chosen to name this story Tales from the Dumpsters of Anchorage in Mid-December, The Sourdough Chronicles. Okay. I can't believe I'm telling you this. So I moved up to Anchorage to go to school, and I met a small community of friends, some of which were dumpster diving acquaintances. And actually, the dumpster diving community is a bit of a cliquey, tight-knit, you know, hard to break into, and they've got this unwritten code of ethics, which is don't disclose the location of your favorite dumpster to amateurs, especially not a room full of strangers. So I think I took this a little too far when I'd come home from a dumpster dive. My girlfriend would be like, "Hey, where were you?" "I can't really tell you." She's like, "I don't care what bin you're rummaging through. I'm never going to go in a dumpster bin." So I knew right away I had a lot of work to do to get her into the community. So I know you guys came here for a story. So this is it, my favorite dumpster diving story. I'm with some friends, Graham and Andy, who actually preferred to be anonymous. But we're heading to the Freddy's off of... Well, I can't tell you where it was, but... Usually you bike to the dumpster, but this one's pretty far. So we drive. And we pull up to the First National Bank across the way there. And we get out and we're heading up the up ramp. And it's the first time we've ever hit this bin, so we're pretty excited. And quick interlude. This is what you wear. This is what I was wearing. And I'm just going to try and promote it a little bit and tell you what you can wear, because I personally think Anchorage needs to take the sport to the next level. So listen up. It's good to have rubber boots. Steel toes, not a bad idea. Like rusty nails or knives or whatever. Just kidding. No, it's actually not. And then you want to wear dark clothes. I don't know why. But flannel's okay to wear in Alaska. And I like to carry a thermometer because I know that below negative 15, anything is fair game. It doesn't matter how expired it is. So this is the particular outfit I had on the night of December the 10th, 2010. So we're heading up this up ramp and everything's going smooth, no one around. All of a sudden, did you guys hear that? I look over at Graham and Andy and they're like, "Gotta get in there." They're thinking we're gonna hide in the garbage. I'm like, "Great idea." So we get back, we're getting up. Okay. Oh my God. This is the first time we're actually gonna be busted dumpster diving. So we're like, "Let's get in." I'm like, "Nah." So this, you know, whatever. We go to get in. And out pops this little head from the dumpster. This guy does a little gopher check. This guy's like in his mid-50s. Now, there's no like secret handshake to tell if you're part of the diving community, but clearly this guy was in the bin, so I think he qualifies. But I mean, this guy, talk about pioneers. This guy was the real deal. I mean, he had so much etiquette that he felt bad that we showed up late. He left us with like a pineapple, a couple bags of Twinkies, and some really nice loaves of sourdough, pretty fresh. I mean, that in itself is a wicked find. But so we're all looking at each other like, "Who is this guy?" And then he backs up and he disappears to the bottom right of the bin. Where the hell did this guy go? I've never seen this before. This gray truck pulls around the back of the bin. He opens the bin from the side and they start loading all their bounty into the back of the truck. And within seconds, they're driving off down the fading streetlights of Muldoon. And I mean, wherever. And I don't care too much for that dumpster. You know, I was so starstruck. So I'm like, I need a getaway driver, right? So I go home to my girlfriend. I'm like, Allie, I mean, girlfriend, you really need to drive. She apparently would, but her driver's license expired. So she's actually warming up to it, and I tricked her into eating some dumpster bread, which is actually kind of mean, but it was this really good loaf of sourdough, and I made some French toast, and I'm going to wrap things up with a quote from her. I think this is a big revelation for her. She says, "As I'm sitting on my dumpster couch, watching our broken dumpster TV, eating my dumpster sourdough bread, I thought there was no use in fighting it." It's pretty sad. But I knew I had finally gained some validation in my dumpster diving career when I was on the way out the door for my last dive, and she looks me in the eye and she says, "Baby, will you pick me up a loaf of sourdough?"
You're listening to Arctic Entries on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards.
Since telling that story, Crompton has moved away from Alaska, all the way to Canada, where he studies the physics of glaciers.
And we hope to explore new dumpsters?
Yes. Anyone may volunteer to tell a story at our live Arctic Entries events. For more on that, visit arcticentries.com. Our stories on this show feature pioneers, homesteaders, and self-starters.
Now we'll hear from a well-known adventurer and associate professor of environmental science and outdoor studies at Alaska Pacific University. This is Carl Tobin.
Well, thank you very much. Sweet stories going on here. I'm really not a real pioneer or anything, and certainly never been a homesteader, and more of a self-stopper, I suppose. So I'm not going to tell a story about myself. I'm kind of going to come into it every once in a while, but it's a story about one of the many people I've met in my life that really are self-starters and really are pioneers. And this is about a friend of mine named Doug Buchanan, who I knew in Fairbanks. Doug and I, we shared some connections. Doug picked me up hitchhiking once in December, and that was our connection. And about a week or two later, Doug and I and two other people were getting into an airplane on Christmas Eve, and we flew into Mount Drum, which some of you probably saw. It's a big Alaskan mountain in the Copper Valley there. And we flew in there, and it was dark when we landed, and dark for the next 10 days or something. And it was cold, and we went over the mountain, skied out to the road, and it was a great adventure, you know. And that was my connection with Doug. We were both climbers, but different types of climbers. And Doug was this is very innovative and self-starting and pioneering on his part. He was a winter mountaineer. I don't mean someone that got a weird idea that wouldn't it be cool to climb McGinley in the winter. No, someone who was a winter mountaineer. It was like a November and December and January and the balmy month of February. That was Doug's climbing season. It was just like the way he was. He wasn't trying to make a statement. Actually, he didn't make statements about his climbing. No published articles. Maybe it says Ignatz if that's a reference to Doug in some literature. But no one's ever heard of him probably through his climbing, unless you lived in Fairbanks and heard all the rumors about all the wild, crazy stuff. You know, summers were for something else, and springs they were for carving ornate alley-oop pipes and running the National Rifle Association. He was on the board. What do you think of that? And all of these things. Ex-Vietnam vet, two tours of duty in Vietnam, officer, helicopter pilot. That was Doug. But I knew him through climbing, and really the most innovative pioneering thing he did was start a climbing club called the Alaskan Alpine Club. Not the Alaska Alpine Club, but the Alaskan Alpine Club, which Doug started in reaction to the Park Service's sort of expanding muscle from a climber's point of view in Alaska. They all of a sudden, the Wrangell-St. Elias, that great range, was in a national park. What are we going to do? McKinley National Park was expanded and became Denali National Park, and there were peak fees and rangers staring at you and stuff like that. And so Doug wanted to sort of protect climbers' rights with this club. It wasn't a club to talk about climbing and things like that. It was to protect climbers' rights. And if you get on the web, go to AlaskanAlpineClub.org or .com, I can't remember, I just clicked the Google link, and it has the bylaws there. The first bylaw out of about eight says, to be a member, all you have to do is say you're a member. You know, let's try it out there, real quick. I'm a member of the Alaskan Alpine Club. So, let's hear it. Sweet, we just 200 or 300 more members, you know? And look, here's a pin right here, Alaskan Alpine Club pin, you know? And if, you can apply for climbing grants, or they had a publication. There's a museum in Fairbanks that Doug put together. In other words, Doug was the club, okay? So maybe this is the story of the Alaskan Alpine Club and not Doug, because the story of the Alaskan Alpine Club is all about Doug, but Doug's story is much broader than that. I'm telling you a small part of it. One thing the Alaskan Alpine Club did, Doug did, was get it accepted to membership in the UIAA. Now, if you go to AMH or REI and buy a rope, on there's a sticker on the end that says UIAA approved. If you want to be an international climbing guide, you get certified by the UIAA. If the president of Sweden wants to ask someone about climbing regulations and this, that, in their country, they go to the UIAA for advice. So essentially, Doug was like, he'd walk into these international meetings in Budapest and Sapporo and everything, and he would stomp for climbers' rights and form consortiums of observer clubs that weren't members of the UIAA. France has only one member, by the way. United States has another club in it. It's the American Alpine Club. And Doug, are members of the UIA. It's like Yasser Arafat walking into the United Nations, pretty much. But more severe. More severe. And so Doug would go to all these meetings and was so focused on climbers' rights, and they just wanted to talk about ropes and guides and stuff. He pissed them off like royally, flying over there. And Doug was a laborer. He worked out of the laborers' hall in Fairbanks, just to let you know, he was not an independently wealthy person. Unless Doug Buchanan really does stand for DB. He came from Yakima, and I'm thinking maybe he got some money from that thing. But anyway, different story. So what happened with the UIAA is amazing. Doug asked me to attend a board meeting for them. I was living in Flagstaff. He called me up. Go to the board meeting. It's at the Lowell Observatory. I show up. The president, Grand Poobah, the UIAA, the Swiss dude, wasn't even going to let me in. He goes, it's not because of you. No, not at all. It's because of that man. And I knew he was speaking to Doug. But I did get in there. I recorded the meeting and surreptitiously gave him a little tape to Doug so that he could look for strange facts at the UIAA board meeting. But really, it's nice to hear that end alarm there. But this story really doesn't have an end. Okay? There's no end to this story. But a good story may have a good denouement. And the denouement of this story is, if you want to know more about Doug and learn more about his story, go up to Fairbanks on the 19th of May. We're having a wake for him there, and it's going to be rocking at the Mushers Hall, 7 p.m. Cheers.
Buchanan's wake occurred May 2012 in Fairbanks. That last story was told by Carl Tobin. If you'd like to hear more from Carl, he has a book out on the Alaska Range. You're listening to Arctic Entries on KSKA Anchorage.
This hour, we hear Alaskans tell seven-minute true stories. Telling a live story in 7 minutes without any notes is difficult, so the host of our live program helped the storytellers out a little bit. You may have noticed the timer by now. At 5 minutes, they give our Arctic Entries storytellers a warning. And then another timer sounds at 7 minutes. This lets the storytellers know that it is time to tie things up.
Now we'd like to break things up a bit and feature some music from local musician Seth Boyer of Anchorage. Right around the time this song was recorded, Boyer quit his day jobs to spend more time with his music. Here he is, Seth Boyer.
How you guys doing tonight? Can you hear anything? Anything? Yes? All right, cool. So this song's called Lie to Me.
You stood there with that stupid grin across your face, and a scarlet little rose behind your ear. Why'd you let the thorns stay in? Now they siphon from your skin. Pools of red no bigger than a tear. We tumbled through the trees before the band was done. Pushed me up against a willow filled with birds. We were thankful for the song, but we did not sing along. Mouths preoccupied with anything but words. Wake me up, make coffee every morning. Keep me sane and well outside my head. Drink with me some whiskey by the full moonlight. Lie to me, say you'll be all right. I hungered for you ever since that afternoon. If you were there, you didn't make your presence known. Well, I wandered all around, but I did not hear a sound. So crestfallen, I turned and headed home. The chimney coughed its smoke into the summer air. As I reached the old log cabin for the night, there should have been a whole damn choir as you laid out by the fire to score the primal beauty of that sight. Wake me up, make coffee every morning. Keep me sane and well outside my head. Drink with me some whiskey by the full moonlight. Lie to me, say it'll be all right. My darling dear, my sun and stars, my everything. And all those hollow pseudonyms. If you could do for me these things, I swear to you, I'd realize you're everywhere. Wake me up, make coffee every morning. Keep me sane and well outside my head. Drink with me some whiskey by the full moonlight. Lie to me, say it'll be alright. Lie to me, say everything will be alright.
Thank you.
Thank you, Seth Boyer. Boyer's album Pre-Exodus was produced by Evan Phillips in Anchorage. You just heard a live recording from our April 2012 Arctic Entries event.
Each month, the Arctic Entries Storyboard works with 7 Alaskans to help them shape their stories so they can share them at our live event, which is held the second Tuesday of each month. And, as you just heard, the stories are punctuated by local music.
Now we'll hear a story from Donna. Not many of us can say that we were born in Anchorage. Donna was not only born here, but she was raised in Anchorage in the 1940s. Here's Donna to share with us what Anchorage used to be like.
All right. Well, my folks came up from Texas in 1939. They wanted to find gold and they wanted a homestead. So they drove up to Seattle, and it took 7 days on the Alaska steamship to get up here. And when they got here, they had to walk up the hill on the bluff area, and there was just a little muddy rut road. 4th and 5th Avenue were just barely there. No roads were past 9th, and those were survey lines. And so they spent 2 or 3 years trying to get everything together. Dad got on at the Alaska Railroad immediately, and they worked so that he could buy some saws and axes and packboards and whatever, snowshoes, because he knew he was going to homestead. And meanwhile, my sister and I were born, and Dad said he said, we need to stake out a homestead. So I went to the land office, and they said, well, up on the upper Chugach is all open. And so there were no lights, nothing there, whatever type. And so Dad said, well, I'm way back out there. Well, there was no roads. There were survey lines, and there was a little access road next to the railroad where the railroad fellows could tend the tracks and everything. So we got on the railroad, went out to Potter's Marsh, and Dad said, here's where we want to get off. So we got off, and Dad looked up. He said, someplace about up in there is where I want to be. So we just went around Potter's Marsh, went up through the woods, and we got up there to a little flat place, which is now Bear Valley, where Bear Valley School is. And Dad turned around. You could see Fire Island and the Alaska Range. He said, this is it. So we staked out a homestead, and we realized after years it was 3 miles down and then 3 miles back up. And pretty soon the survey line came out, and people had jeeps and stuff. Occasionally they would come out. Of course, most of them would get stuck. But it pushed as far as where Rabbit Creek goes right now. And so we were able to drive out there, and then eventually the road went in later than that. But we had to pack everything we had up to our homestead. Well, we finally got saws and axes and everything, and so we cut down timber and stuff right where we wanted to build our place. And we cut the logs down, and we used our draw knife to peel them, and my sister and I chinked moss and stuff into the cracks, whatever the stuff, and we lived in a wall tent meanwhile. And so pretty soon there's a fellow who, Mr. Winchester, he was called, had a nice D8 cat, and he moved down a little farther in the lower skirts of where DeArmond is now, and he says, well, why don't I push a road up there to your house, whatever. So eventually, a little muddy rut road. Most of the time, we couldn't even get up there because we had to corrugate the road with all kind of trees that we cut, and then most of the time, we spent digging out. So we put our pack boards on and stuff and packed whatever groceries we had, and there weren't stores in those days like there are now, so we lived off of moose and fish, and we picked berries and for jams and jellies and syrups, and so we did lots of canning and everything. And at the age of five I started going with my dad moose hunting. Well, it wasn't too far because usually we could look out our front window, and usually the first hour of moose season something came by, whatever, you know, and kind of reached. No, yeah, so so we had moose, which was good. But I shot my first moose when I was 9 years old. And Dad told me, he said, now you can go and walk for miles to hunt moose, but if you'll see where they come down through the valleys, they feed early in the morning and late at night, sit there and you can call, they'll come to you. And that's true. So I learned to call moose or whatever. In fact, this year at the Alaska State Fair, they had Alaska Moose Calling Contest, and I won first place. I was surprised. I was the only woman, 15 guys. I says, I don't have a chance. You know? He says, well, you actually sounded like a moose. I said, thank you. Yeah. But anyway, it worked. So we... Yeah.
Oh.
Oh, 30 seconds. Well, a moose and a cow call, a bull and a cow call are two different ball games, whatever. Because if you're out hunting moose, if you sound like a bull, a lot of times that's real intimidating, and they run off, you know, if they hear another bull, whatever, unless they're a good-sized bull. So you want to sound like a cow or a lonely cow or whatever that is, you know. And then here's the bull, and yeah, okay, and the bull always comes to where you are. And I am a hunting guide today. I've done hunting for 52 years, and you can sit here and you tell your clients to sit over here, because they're going to come to you, and just make sure that you shoot before they get to me, whatever. Yeah. But a bull, whatever, as I said, they can get pretty excited times, but if you hear the that's a bull moose. If you hear that, whatever. And a cow moose, whatever. And then Dad said it was kind of like a bell shape. You kind of start low and then high and then down. Oh boy, a moose, man, they're after it, whatever. So it's a cow. All right. Okay. Anyway, so, oh boy. Anyway, we need to get to this. My dad finally, we got to where we could get home in the old Jeep. He made a skid, log skid, and he brought home an old-fashioned bathtub. We had no running water or anything, no septic, you know, at that time. We went down to the creek, and you'd bring the water and heat it. But I thought, wow, a bathtub, you know. So Dad had there's a great big spruce tree, and he trimmed the leaves or the limbs off, shoved the tub up underneath the tree, and then cut wood and everything and stacked it on one side. So you would go out to the fire pit, heat your water in your five-gallon Blazo can, pour it over in there, and then you get under and take your bath, you know. That was great. Well, I went out of the tent one morning, and I went over there, and evidently sometime prior to that, a little baby porcupine had climbed up on top and fell over in the bathtub. And of course, it's pretty slick, you know. So here he's standing on his hind legs, jumping up, trying to get out. And all I could hear was the little toenails, click, 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 click. So I ran back in. I said, Mother, there's a porcupine tap dancing in her bathtub. I don't remember saying that, but she said, yeah, you did. So anyway, we started digging our well, of course, hand digging. That's the only way. Mother would get down there, and she'd use a pick and shovel. Then my sister and I would be up there, and we had a windlass thing with a big rope onto the big bucket down there, and she would fill the bucket, and we'd pull it up and dump it out. And then when Dad was there in the evenings or the weekends, you know, he would take turn. And we had split logs, and we pushed them up against the side, you know. And one day, a huge black cloud was coming over. I thought, what in the world? And it was like dirt was falling from the sky. I thought, what is this? Well, we didn't know what it was. Well, Mount Spur had erupted, this big cloud of ash, and we never heard that. So anyway, so she gets out, and we get into the house, and we see this stuff coming down, you know, and it was getting dark. And we were in the process of building our septic. We had a big, huge hole right up against the house, the area that we were going to put our plumbing in. And a little while later, we heard this, help. What in the world? Help. So Mother opens the door. She says, who is this? She says, well, this is Cecil Clark, and I fell in some hole here. And he says, I can't get out. And he was a neighbor, a fellow with Clark's Road, if you know where that is, up Upper Rabbit Creek there. And he came over to check on us while, you know, I was there. So anyway, he fell in the hole. We went out through the ladder and helped him out and whatever. So, but thousands more stories or whatever, but it was good growing up in the early 40s, and times has changed a bunch. Yeah, so.
Rosie, can we hear that bull moose call one more time?
Yeah, here you go.
That's just fantastic. On this episode of Arctic Entries, our theme is sourdoughs. We're hearing from pioneers, homesteaders, and self-starters.
Now, Nathan Havey is a guy who likes to make things happen. He's been an actor, a clown, and is now a freelance media consultant. He's less of an old-timer and more of a young guy self-starter type. Here's Nathan Havey.
So, I am a huge fan of tortured metaphors. And I think that the theme this month is a very, very good one for tortured metaphors, especially about sourdough. So I am not someone with tremendous experience about sourdough, so please forgive any places where the extent to which I torture this metaphor goes awry from the metaphor that it's supposed to be. Okay? So, and awry was not an intentional pun, but there it was. My story is a story about building a business, but not just any business, a business that is actually going to serve you and be something that you want in your life, that you know, has the good work-life balance and you actually enjoy what you're doing with your time. And we're going to call that Delicious Sourdough. okay? So in order to make delicious sourdough, you have to start with a starter if you're lucky. If you're not, you just have to put flour and water together and leave it open to the air, and hopefully something will start to happen, okay? So my story starts in October a few years ago when I was laid off from a social media consulting firm in Boston. It wasn't a total surprise. I was not exactly happy there. There was some unrest, and it just sort of made sense. So it wasn't a big shock, but I was not exactly prepared for it either. So I got myself on unemployment and put applications out, you know, 9 ways from Sunday as quick as I could. And a couple of weeks later, had heard nothing, not one phone call, not one bite, no interest, no interviews, nothing. So I have a personal philosophy: when things aren't working right, or when you're not satisfied with the way something is going, it's because you aren't playing a big enough game. So you got to play a bigger game, and then the thing that you were stressed out about is nothing. It's a non-issue, right? So that's kind of how I decided to get myself into a thing called 80 till 30. So here's the game. I need to make money to pay rent. Big problem. Bigger problem, I want to be debt-free by my 30th birthday. I have $60,000 in student loan debt, and there are 80 weeks until I turn 30. Okay, that's a big game. That's good. So, 80till30.blogspot.com. Here's the rules. I start up a blog, and every week I have to post a video on my progress, or lack thereof. No hiding, no secrets. It's all out there for whoever chooses to look at it. Now, I had no illusions that anyone would possibly think this was interesting, except for me, but it was a good public accountability, and I hate looking bad, so that was a great thing for me. So what? Week one, post the intro video, lay out those rules. Week two, start strategizing about how it is exactly that I'm going to pay off all of my student loan debt, which is $875 per week, for 80 weeks. That's on top of money for rent, food, etc. $875 just to the student loans, okay? That's the game. So think about it. I thought about going back to some of my old work, which was as a server at the Olive Garden. Decided against that pretty fast. I started posting a whole bunch of stuff on Craigslist. I in college was known as the king of the idiot sports. So I used to be a clown. I can balloon animal make. I can juggle. I've got a little bit of magic tricks, but that doesn't pay all that well, and the kids get rough. So it's not a great idea. I posted a thing about ballroom dance. I'm actually an intro to ballroom dance instructor as well. No bites on that either. I thought about doing English language tutoring. Nobody wanted that, or at least not on Craigslist. So then I started to think about, what else could I do here? It came to, well, social media is what I've kind of been doing, so maybe I should post some ads for that. And I did get a little interest there. So, okay, that works out. So week three, new opportunity, I learn about sleep studies. 14 days in a climate-controlled, light-controlled room. You have no idea what time it is. They turn on the lights, they turn off the lights, they feed you, they don't, and they see what you do. And it's like $3,000. So my fiance wasn't all excited about that, but I was excited until I found out that you actually have for the entire time to wear a rectal thermometer. Maybe not on that. So moving on, week six, I get a really cool opportunity to dig foundation holes for a friend of mine who's doing an expansion on the house. So I've never done anything like that before. So I was like, sure, why not? This would be great. So I go to out to Concord, Massachusetts in January and try and dig through 6 inches of frozen ground to do these foundation holes. That was over about a week later, and I never went back to that. So I can't believe it's 5 minutes already. So, doing it quickly, week 14, some friends of mine call and ask me to be their social media person for their iPad case company, Happy Owl Studio. Very good cases. You should check them out. And that actually pays enough for me to get off of unemployment and be fine. Paying rent, making, you know, buying groceries, no problem. So there it is. 14 weeks into the 80-week game, the original problem is solved. And I've got a great job. I work from home. I don't have to get dressed if I don't want to. And it's great. I, you know, can do kind of whatever I want, which is nice. So right there, I did consider just quitting the game. But in those 14 weeks, I've had a whole lot of people like comment on the blog. People are starting to give me crap if I'm late in posting a weekly video. Like, people are watching. It's crazy. So I keep posting, and in week 23, a friend of mine in Washington cuts a trailer together of all of my videos and submits it to a reality TV show. They didn't bite, but the trailer's epic. I think it's going to be on the Facebook page here. So I keep going, keep going. Week 27, I'm $10,000 behind. So I'm making payments, but it's not going well. Week 56, we're going to fast forward. We have now moved to Alaska. I met Mr. Vic Fisher, who you're going to all hear from in a little bit later tonight, and he helped to connect me. So things are moving, but not fast, and then disaster strikes. I have a disagreement with one of my major organs. Doesn't go well. Pancreatitis from a little bit too much whiskey one night, and I'm in the hospital and can't do anything. And it's a really great time to pause and take a look at what's going on. So I figure, why isn't this working? What is it that I can offer that I'm not offering just yet? And I think and think, it's been in front of my face the whole time. It's video. I've been making these videos every week. It's what I like to do. It's what I want to do. Why don't I just do that? So I start offering that, and boom, in the next 6 weeks, the Inn at Turn Lake, thank you, Willow, is here. They hire me to do a big thing. Planned Parenthood, thank you, Caitlin, and they hire me to do a whole thing. We've also got the Kobuk, new website up today, thank you, Nina. It also hires me to do a whole thing, and they're just a few of the many people who did it. Where is my game? Well, this is week 76. 100 student loan debt total for the United States has exceeded $1 trillion. 36,000 of that is mine. I got 4 weeks and I'm still playing hard. So if anybody here is interested in some social media work, I will be around at intermission. Thank you.
Shortly after this performance, an anonymous follower was inspired by Havy and decided to pay off the remainder of his debt. At age 30, he's now debt-free and ready for his next project.
I also heard he has been volunteering to help with the Arctic Entries website.
Yeah, it's looking great. By the way, you're listening to Arctic Entries. Visit our website at arcticentries.com.
So our next and final storyteller is a living legend.
Oh, I love this guy.
Yeah, it's really hard not to. Vic Fisher worked to help draft the Alaska State Constitution. He has studied and participated in Alaska law and politics for over 50 years.
Yeah, and in 2006, I got to see him get his honorary Doctor of Laws degree at the University of Alaska, Anchorage. We're honored to introduce Vic Fisher. Here he is live at the Snow Goose Theater in Anchorage.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. I've been sitting here listening to lots of good storytellers, clowns, actors, whatever, and wondering what I should talk about. At one point, I was telling somebody during intermission, I had this thought of telling about doing kayaking off West Chichagov Island, north of Sitka, and being eye to eye with a whale, with a humpback, with an eye like this, about this far, virtually maybe two arms length away from me. One of the great thrills of my life. Nothing funny about it, it was just a lifetime experience. Anyway, I'm going to tell you quickly about coming to Alaska, what brought me here. I was on a troop ship during World War II, crossing the Atlantic on the way to France. We were in a convoy of about 150 ships, and it took us 2 weeks across because the convoy went at the speed of the slowest of the ships, and those were tankers. And we had troop ships in the middle and cargo ships and tankers and then whatever, and minesweepers and destroyers on the outside dropping depth charges, keeping the U-boats away. Anyway, it was a long trip, and after I got over being seasick first couple of days in the North Atlantic storm, I started thinking, okay, what do I want to do with myself when I get back, and where do I want to do it? And I had gone to the University of Wisconsin before I enlisted and enrolled as in electrical engineering department. And I'd always thought that's what I would pursue because as a kid, I always played with electricity and building magnets and coils and this and that and so on. I once wired my desk so that if my brother tried to get into a drawer, he'd get a shock. As I was ruminating about my future, I decided I really want to do something more than engineering. I want to have more of a social purpose in my life. And so I went in the ship's library and went through a bunch of books, and a great one was Space, Time, and Architecture. And I thought, architecture, well, that's my technical side. It's for people. As I read the book, I discovered there's a field such as city planning. Well, that's what I decided. I'd be a city planner. And in the library, I also started reading books about the states because I had come from the East Coast to Wisconsin. I liked going west, so I thought, well, I'll go all the way west. And, so I read about Oregon, and I skipped California. I went to Oregon, state of Washington, and there was a series of books on the states and the territories, and reading about Tacoma and Seattle and so on, I found there's a place even further away, and that's Alaska. And so I got the Alaska book, and I was sold, so I was going to be a city planner in Alaska. And after the war, I wrote a letter to the University of Alaska up near Fairbanks, and I asked them if they had a degree program in architecture. Well, the University of Alaska still doesn't have that. They said we have civil engineering and mining and agriculture and English and whatever else, and it was a nice handwritten letter, and they said you might try University of Washington, which I did, and they weren't taking out-of-state students because there were so many veterans coming back under the GI Bill, which was what was going to finance my education. So I went back to Wisconsin, created my own program as a foundation for planning, went off to MIT to get a graduate degree, and when I was finishing there, planning was just coming into popular fore, and I had lots of job offers. I couldn't decide which one to take. Alaska was not in my horizon at that point. And one day there was a notice on the job board, town planner for Alaska, Bureau of Land Management, and sort of my dreams were realized. All of a sudden, Alaska was there. And my wife and I went to Philadelphia, we were living in Pennsylvania, fixed up to go up to the Arctic, and we got 10 records that we couldn't live without for the next few years. And drove, camped all the way across the country and up the Alaska Highway, which was in pretty horrible shape, and I haven't even gotten started yet. get to Anchorage on the one street that was paved, Fourth Avenue. Donna may remember when that was being paved. And lo and behold, we stop in front of the federal building that's now the old federal building, and there's a parking meter next to us. And across the street is a beautiful, large record store in the Reed Building next to the Fourth Avenue Theater. And anyway, we ended up living in a outside the city limits in a converted garage, 14 by 22 little cabin with an oil cook stove in one corner, chemical toilet in the other, and carried water in from the neighbors, and it was heaven. It was just ideal as life could be. Anchorage City had 11,000 people then. The area had 30,000, including a lot of military at the time. And I was going to tell you a story, except for that harmonica over there, about the first week going off to Nularo, going out to the bush and getting to experience a village in the first days in Alaska, and then flying back in a very small plane, and clouds coming down over the mountains, and we wandered around and ended up in Galena and got stuck for 3 days, and I learned a lot about what Alaska life is like, including the patience of traveling in Alaska. It was fabulous. Alaska lived up to everything I expected, except for one downside, and that was the fact that by coming to Alaska, I was no longer a full-fledged citizen of the United States. I was in the territory of Alaska. I had voted for president already, for U.S. senator, for voting members of Congress, and having been in a war to save the world for democracy, or whatever we call the good war in those days. And here I was, and that's how I got involved in statehood, and that's went to the Constitutional Convention and did lots of fascinating things, and it's been a good life, and I'm delighted to see such a fabulous turnout. Thank you.
At Arctic Entries, we typically limit our storytellers to 7 minutes. But in this case, the audience demanded Vic Fisher come back to the stage.
Being a right place at the... being a right place at the right time, I was very fortunate. I got involved in the statehood movement and ran for the Constitutional Convention as a delegate from all of Southeastern, from Cordova, including Kodiak, all the way down the Aleutian chain and Bristol Bay and so on. And I was elected, and the whole election cost me $150, believe it or not. Anyway, it got to Fairbanks in November of 1955 for the meeting of the Constitutional Convention, and got to start meeting other delegates, learning about the delegates who had been elected. I hadn't paid too much attention to other regions at that point. I knew quite a few people, but not all of them. One of the people I'd seen a name, but I knew nothing about him until I got to Fairbanks, and his name was E.B. Collins, a very interesting guy who had been elected to the first territorial legislature, which met in 1913. He was elected speaker of the first territorial House of Representatives. And I thought to myself, how can anyone that old possibly still be on his feet and be able to function in a constitutional convention? He was 82 years old. I'm 88 in a couple of weeks. Thank you.
That was Vic Fisher. Thanks for tuning in to this hour of Arctic Entries. To hear these stories again or to share them with friends, arcticentries.com or alaskapublic.org. We also have information about our show themes and details on how you, too, could tell a story.
We'd like to thank the Arctic Entries Storyboard, the storytellers for this show, and our musical guest, Seth Boyer. All of the proceeds from our shows are donated to a local social services nonprofit organization. Information about this is also on the Arctic Entries website. And thanks to Anchorage's own Super Saturated Sugar Strings for our theme music.
This has been Arctic Entries on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Rosie Robards.
And I'm Jason Brandeis. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to hearing your stories.